Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Laura Higginbotham.
And Laura, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance, about the diagnosis of sepsis and a tragic story that claimed the life of his daughter. Really looking forward to this conversation. I know it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, a tough conversation, but I think very important to raise awareness about sepsis.
But first, we're going to raise awareness about some important research that matters. And our first one is about do not resuscitate orders, and something that we perhaps may have heard about but we've not thought about, which is what if you had a tattoo that said do not resuscitate and you showed up in the emergency room unconscious?
Right.
Who comes up with these ideas? It's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Well, so this actually happened to some physicians in the emergency room in Miami. So a 70-year-old man was brought to the emergency room. He was unconscious and was in need of some life-sustaining measures, but had this tattoo across his chest that said, do not resuscitate, with not underlined. And so those physicians faced that issue of whether or not this tattoo reflected the gentleman's true wishes and intentions.
Yeah, and they actually ended up getting an ethics consult when it became clear that he might well die. And the ethics consult, they said, determined that they did not need to resuscitate him, that that was his intent to have that tattoo. Subsequently, they said they found a living will or some document that expressed his wishes to not be resuscitated, and he died shortly thereafter. What do you think about that ethics decision? Is that something that you think you would have been comfortable with, or would you come down differently?
You know, I'm not sure. It's a really tough question. I think my concern would be, you know, what if this gentleman got the tattoo when he was younger, or got it done as a joke, or for some other reason that didn't necessarily reflect his true intentions now? You know, usually sort of the standard in medicine is that we look for the paperwork that you mentioned that is signed by the person's physician that says, yes, these are my legal intentions. That's a legal document. Or if they don't have one, then we talk to either the patient, if they're conscious, or their family and friends to help reach that determination about where their wishes are. So I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure about this interpretation, but luckily it worked out that they were able to find the paperwork to corroborate that decision.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it would have been really difficult for me because in the absence of more direction, I mean, do not resuscitate. What if you wrote do not harm as a tattoo? Does that mean do not do harm to me or do not do harm to others? Do not resuscitate me. Do not resuscitate others. Do not be aggressive in how you treat. And I understand that we assume we know what it means, but I would have felt very uncomfortable. So I'm so glad that they didn't have to. I think the bottom line is make your wishes known to as many people as you can about what you would like done for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Make sure your friends and families know your wishes.
What's our next research that matters that has to do with an article about kids and window blinds?
This was a study published recently in Pediatrics, and they took a look at data from emergency departments across the United States for about a 25-year time span, so from 1990 to 2015. And they found that almost 17,000 children under age 6 were actually treated in EDs for window blind injuries.
Emergency departments, yeah. It's a little kind of crazy. I hadn't really thought too much about it until I read this, but I now recognize that, yeah, this is a really serious problem. Because, and first off, this was only those that were treated in emergency departments. That means tens of thousands of others probably never get to that level. And these are those cords, for the most part, that kind of go up and down. And I'm thinking, you know, if I'm a 4-year-old and I climb on a chair and I see a string there, I want to pull that string and I want to play with it. And I see the blinds going up and down and how easy it is to get that wrapped in an injury or those blinds falling down and hitting them on the head. And it seems like this is like something that could be preventable as a preventive medicine expert.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think one thing to point out is that most of the injuries weren't serious. But as you mentioned, almost 230 cases of children actually died by getting these cords wrapped around their necks. And so my understanding is that currently sort of safety standards for windows are on a voluntary basis, and there aren't mandatory standards to say, for example, that blinds should be cordless or at a certain height that children can't reach them.
Yeah, I think educating parents, educating listeners, educating grandparents, we could really do much better than this. I think certainly if you have these older blinds that have cords, get that cord tied up higher. Get it out of reach. Make sure the blinds are secured. Let's avoid these type of injuries and deaths. Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Very crazy.
Speaking about things that are crazy, this next one actually is a common problem. I think it's not just about kids, among adults as well. And that is really playing on your cell phones and your computers before you go to bed.
Yeah, I definitely will admit that that's a problem for myself. So this study asked parents of around 234 children to report on the habits of their kids at nighttime. Are they using cell phones, computers, video games, or TV before bed? And then they looked at that to see if there's a relationship between technology use and sleep quality. They found that those children using these technologies before bed were getting less sleep, so about 30 minutes to 1 hour less. The sleep was of worse quality, and the children were more tired in the morning.
This was published in the journal Global Pediatric Health, and I think it is a global health problem that it's not good for you or I to be on our phones right as we're going to sleep, right first thing when we wake up, and certainly not healthy for the children. I mean, 30 minutes less sleep, an hour less sleep, all these other health problems. Put the phone away. Let's even turn it off, something more radical, and let's have a true 8-10 hour cell phone free, game free time period. That's my advice. I need to follow it.
Yeah, I need to follow it too.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, Laura. And this is about something near and dear to me, probably to you as well, I'm certain, which is trying to prevent gun violence, firearm associated violence, and some new research that suggests that two types of measures may impact differently gun violence.
Right. So this is a type of research that looks at the impact of legal changes. So the researchers are actually able to compare data and crime statistics from before enactment of a law to the period afterwards to see what is the true impact of these laws. So one of the findings from their analysis was that lifting restrictions on concealed carry guns, so loosening those restrictions, is associated with an increase in violent crime.
And the other one was about that laws that restrict gun ownership for people convicted of domestic violence, making it more difficult for those with those convictions to obtain guns, actually reduced homicides of female domestic partners. Both these were in the journal Science. They're by researchers from Stanford and Duke University. And I think that these are important things that need to be in the policy arena because, you know, if reasonable gun legislation can reduce firearm violence, it seems like a win-win.
Absolutely. I think that this is some pretty clear evidence of not only the impact that our laws can have, but also showing that the guns are, in fact, associated with violence and mortality statistics, as I think many of us would suspect they would be.
We know that there will be many listeners who have different views on these. We encourage you to look at this. We'll put a link to this on our website. Really provocative and important research. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance, about what we all need to do to prevent sepsis-related complications and infections and death. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Today on Conversations, Laura, we're talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance, about what happens when your body fights you rather than an infection that it's fighting.
Welcome, Dr. Flatley.
Thank you, Laura.
You know, it's wonderful to have you on the show. I suspect some of our listeners really don't know a lot about why an endodontist is talking about sepsis. Tell us how you got interested in sepsis, and it's a difficult story for our listeners and for us, but please do tell us.
Well, it's difficult to talk about. I'm not a physician, but I'm a dentist that over the past 15 years is spending every day educating people about this blanket of death. 15 years ago, my daughter, I retired in 95, and I thought, boy, the golden years are ahead, and it's going to be great. The kids are at home and things like that. And my 23-year-old daughter went in for a simple hemorrhoidectomy, and 5 days later, she was dead. I'd never heard the word sepsis. I practiced and did surgery every day for 25 years and never heard the word. I was in the Navy, never heard the word. And here my daughter turns around and dies from it in a short period of time. It was such a shock to me to realize how extensive it is that I've made this my vocation, if you will.
I'm so sorry.
Could you tell our listeners that don't know, what is sepsis and who are the people that are at risk for it?
Sepsis really is an overreaction of the body to infection, and it could be any infection. It can be bacterial, it can be fungus, parasitic. The infection can come from a bug bite. It can come from a pierced ear, a tattoo, meningitis, flu. Any infection can lead to sepsis. And sepsis now is the leading cause of death in most hospitals. So it's a very serious condition.
And how did your daughter get sepsis? Did you know? Because obviously at the time, a hemorrhoidectomy is kind of a what we all think of as a pretty routine, pretty safe outpatient procedure. But it sounds like many times it maybe isn't what it seems.
Well, I mean, that's what you certainly learn, is there are no simple procedures. And yes, we thought that way too, and so did she. And it was going to be a routine thing. I actually bought her a jet ski the day before, just thinking about when she got over it, would, you know, go out and have some fun. And she picked up an infection in the hospital, and five doctors were attending to her during those 3 or 4 days. And they never recognized the early case of sepsis, the early symptoms, and she was gone. I mean, I'm still in shock. It is preventable. It never should have happened, and 80% of the cases are preventable. So this is something, there is no cure for it, but if you get it early enough, you can eliminate it, if you will.
What are some of the ways that sepsis presents itself? Could you share with us some of the maybe symptoms, just to give our listeners a little bit more of an idea of things that they should look out for if they're developing an infection?
Well, that's what makes sepsis difficult, even for physicians to diagnose it, because there are no concrete signs. There's just a number of different conditions that you see. It could be a temperature, it could be high or low, it could be breathing heavily, could have chills, could have a rash, low urine output. So it's a number of things that you all have to put together that physician has to look for, because again, there is just not one specific thing. If you go to sepsis.org, which is our website, there is, and you can get symptoms card and download this, because there's about 5 or 6 things you need to look for. And if you see these coming, you know, people that have had sepsis and survived say it's like having the worst case of the flu. They feel like they're going to die. I mean, it's that bad. And if you get in early enough and have a screening, they can start the treatment, if you will. There is no cure, but they can start treatment that can prevent you from dying or even losing your arms and legs.
You know, as I think back on my training in medical school, and probably, Laura, maybe the same for you, and Carl, maybe the same for you in dental school, we learned about sepsis. It was part of this kind of standard physiology, sometimes maybe microbiology, pathology, you would see the end result. But you kind of learned it from the standpoint of you've already made the diagnosis. It sounds like making a diagnosis is really the essential element there, and that's not easy. Has that changed?
Not really, and it's interesting that you say that you had the training, because I certainly didn't. I graduated, gosh, 1975, so it's quite a while ago, but I've talked to a lot of dentists, and they still don't get the training, and you can get sepsis from a dental infection just like you can from meningitis. So not all physicians and not all dentists are up on this, because no one's taken ownership. Medicine and dentistry is so specialized now that, you know, there's a doctor does the hand, a doctor does the foot, but there is no doctor specialized in sepsis. So it's everyone's problem. We all have to be akin to it. And so does the public, because 80% of the cases of sepsis start in the community. And once you get it, for every hour of delay of getting antibiotics, your chance of dying goes up 8%. So if you go to the hospital and they make you sit in the reception room in the emergency room for 6 hours, your chance of dying went up 50%. It's a very time-sensitive disease. You've got to recognize it early, and as soon as it's recognized, you have to get the antibiotics and fluids going right away, because that's the appropriate treatment right now, is antibiotics and fluids, maybe surgery to get rid of the infection, but you need to get the infection under control, because once it gets going, it's like a wildfire and you cannot put it out, and it gets to a point where you can't be saved.
Well, you know, I wanted to follow up on something that you said, which was sort of how difficult it can be to make the diagnosis and then also to get early initiation of treatment, so early treatment with antibiotics and fluids. One of the hospitals that I trained at during my career actually did have a sepsis protocol that really emphasized, in a protocolized way, diagnosis and treatment with antibiotics within 1 hour. I'm curious if you could give us a sense of how many hospitals have these types of protocols now.
Well, I go across the country. As a matter of fact, I've even been to Europe and visited places, and not all hospitals are the same. I've been told that less than 50% of the hospitals in the United States use evidence-based protocols. A lot of hospitals have sepsis coordinators where there's one nurse that kind of heads up the whole thing. But the entire hospital, every nurse has to be looking for sepsis. It's not just one person's job. So it depends a lot on which hospital you go to. I was just recently in the hospital for cellulitis, which can become septic. And the way I was treated, I actually looked up the hospital, and they did not have a sepsis protocol. It was actually, there are ratings that you can look up your hospital. But you need to pick your hospital based on competency, not on convenience. Very critical. So when your doctor refers you to the hospital, ask him, do they have a sepsis protocol? Because I must stress, you say, well, I've never heard of sepsis. It must not be common. It is very common. I didn't know that. When I lost my daughter, a physician standing next to me, I was shocked. I'd never heard of it. In the last 15 years, 4 million people in the United States have died. Since my daughter died, 4 million others have died, and over 10 million suffer post-sepsis syndrome problems and other conditions related to sepsis. This is not uncommon. It's everywhere. And I guarantee the listeners, in the next 2 weeks, now that you've heard the word, I guarantee you will find out or know someone who's had sepsis, possibly died from, because a lot of times when they put on the death certificate, they'll put complications from pneumonia, complications from the flu. Anyone who dies of any infection, so if you have flu, meningitis, MRSA, cellulitis, anything like that, and you die from that, you die of sepsis. So sepsis is a common pathway for infection, and they say it could be the number one cause of death in the world.
Well, we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance, about what happens when your body fights you rather than an infection. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance, really about the life-changing and tragic death of his daughter at a young age from sepsis, and his work around the United States, around the world, advocating on helping patients and providers diagnose and get this treated to save lives. And Dr. Flatley, it seemed like you believe and say, and we believe and say, that intravenous antibiotics and intravenous fluids are really the key and cornerstone. And the fluid seems easy and straightforward because those really help do tissue perfusion. Help us understand the choice of when to use the antibiotics, because if you give the antibiotics to someone who maybe doesn't have sepsis, you could cause very serious problems. How do you manage and advise patients, providers even, to think about that trade-off?
That's a very important question, because antibiotic stewardship and antibiotic resistance to it. In a lot of cases, antibiotics, if you have viral infections, antibiotics won't work. So for people to go and demand they have antibiotics because they've got the flu or some kind of viral-related infection doesn't do any good. Matter of fact, it creates problems. There now are tests that within 20 minutes they can tell whether it's bacterial or viral. That's key. And whenever you get antibiotics, always ask, is it necessary? But if they determine it's a bacterial infection or suspect it is, they normally give a broad spectrum because they don't know exactly what bug it is. Then they culture and find out exactly what bug, and then they'll switch you to the appropriate antibiotic that is very specific for that. So that's where your physician knowledge is so critical, because it's getting the right antibiotic and getting it there as fast as possible, and then also getting you off the antibiotics if it's not working so that you don't overuse antibiotics. Now, we lose 258,000 people a year, 258,000. If we run out of the appropriate antibiotics, that number could triple that quick. So right now, antibiotics, there is no cure, there is no pill, there's nothing except antibiotic fluid and possibly surgery as supportive care, but we got to have those antibiotics. So take them only when you need them and as your doctor directs. Very critical.
I think that's a really great point, too, that you sort of made about how we treat sepsis in the future. So if we're not using antibiotics appropriately currently, then down the line, we might not have the antibiotics to use for sepsis. So thank you for making that point. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit more about some of the complications that may develop in people who survive sepsis. So what is post-sepsis syndrome?
Well, it's a term that wasn't used till about 5 or 6 years ago. And we had a meeting in Chicago of stakeholders, because it was thought when you survived sepsis and you left the hospital, you survived. You're okay. Well, there's about 1.4 million survivors every year that have sepsis, but they survive. And about half of those, so about 700,000, have something called post-sepsis syndrome. And the condition varies. It could be loss of hair. It could be pain. It could be sweating, loss of taste, cognitive dysfunctions. A wide variety, and most physicians don't recognize this. It's only come into view in the last 5 or 6 years. And so they go to their doctor and, you know, they put them on tranquilizers. So we don't know really how to treat that yet, but we have to recognize that it is a disease, and people get where they cannot go to work. They're disabled. So post-sepsis syndrome is a very serious condition, and I probably belong to maybe a dozen internet-based survival groups. And what these people suffer from is awful. And these are not the ones who you see. I mean, people who have amputations, you obviously see that. And there are like 38 amputations per day based on sepsis cases. So that in itself is just an unbelievable number. But post-sepsis syndrome is a true malady, and it's a real problem for a lot of people.
You have a moving page on your website called Faces of Sepsis, and one of the moving stories was about your daughter. Is there any other story on that website you would like to mention that illustrates some of the things that you've been talking about?
It's amazing because when we started to face the sepsis trademarked and all that, and it's really become very popular because it gives a place for people to vent themselves and tell their story, and it helps them heal. It also is categorized by the condition they have. So maybe it's pancreatitis or whatever. You can go in under that disease and look it up. But what you see as you go through these different stories, and again, we're up to 750 now, is first of all, it's a lack of awareness. They wait too long. So I've lost a couple friends who had the flu and thought, well, and we all do this. You say, well, I'll just see how I feel tomorrow. Well, these two individuals I know didn't have it tomorrow. So it's very critical. If you start to get these symptoms and you have a rapid heart rate or you're breathing hard or you feel like you got the worst case of the flu, do not delay. Call your physician. Go to the ER. Get a sepsis screening. Ask, could it be sepsis? And when I go through those stores, it's usually delayed. They didn't get early enough treatment, or it wasn't recognized when they went to the hospital. So you have to speak up. When my daughter went to the hospital, she waited in the reception room because she looked okay, and she sat there for 5 hours. 5 times 8, 40% chance of dying. That's how much it went up. So it's very critical to recognize the symptoms early.
Given how prevalent sepsis is, why do you think more people aren't aware of it, both patients and providers? And I also wonder if you could comment on how your organization, Sepsis Alliance, is working to alleviate that gap in knowledge.
Well, you're right. A lot of people have not heard of it, and even physicians have said that even they only use it about 10% of the time. I mean, it's not used. Why, I don't know. I can tell you in the last 15 years since we started this, and when I started it in 2004, if you put sepsis in the email, it got thrown out as a misspelled word. But in the last 15 years, we've got a Sepsis Awareness Month. We've got a World Sepsis Day. There's a proclamation just signed by the WHO of 194 countries. So countries are getting involved because worldwide every year, about 6 million children die of this. So it's very prevalent. It's everywhere, but people need to know. And again, going back to the community, it's so critical that the public be aware of this because they get it much before they see their doctor, and if they got to get in there early. That's very critical. So that's what the Sepsis Alliance has been doing is public awareness. We also have a very strong nursing program because we believe that nurses are the key first line of defense. They're right there with the patients. They see them on a daily basis. They're with them all day. Very critical. So we have a very strong nursing program, and we go into hospitals. We're working with sepsis coordinators now. We're doing everything possible because at 258,000, I mean, that's 5 times the amount of people that die in car accidents. And look how much we worry about our children driving a car. Maybe we lose about 50,000. You have a 5 times greater chance of dying of sepsis than you do get killed in a car wreck, and we don't know anything about it.
And it's, you know, the tragedy that you discuss, Dr. Flatley, and the experience, you know, we know in the sepsis of physical shock, but you really speak to the psychological shock as well. And I wonder if you have a kind of some final thoughts you want to share with our listeners to help prevent physical shock and lifelong psychological shock and disability among patients and families.
Well, I don't know, because I tell you, I haven't gotten over the shock in the last 15 years of losing my daughter. What I would say is take no infection lightly, none. Take no surgery lightly. There is no routine surgery. And to lose someone, the pain is forever. But one thing I think is key, because I've had sepsis. I had it in 2006, and I think my daughter actually saved me because I went in, I had a urinary tract infection. I thought I did. I went to the physician to see. They ran some tests, and he came back. He said, you've got a urinary tract infection. I'm going to give you some antibiotics, and you can go home. I said, well, I don't want to go home. He said, what do you mean you don't want to go home? I said, I'm concerned about sepsis. He said, oh, you don't have to worry about sepsis. I said, I'm not going home. You know, after seeing what my daughter went through, knowing how I felt, and it was different than anything else I'd experienced, well, it's a good thing because I was in the hospital for the next 10 days, had 2 surgeries on the weekend to get rid of the infection. So just the fact that I said I'm concerned about sepsis is very critical. whenever you go to the hospital for anything, tell them you're concerned about sepsis. I don't care if you're going there for a hangnail. Let them know, because you can get sepsis from a manicure. You can actually get sepsis from any kind of cut, any kind of cut. So you cannot be too careful. Take no infection lightly. Be aware and seek a sepsis screening as soon as you suspect something.
Well, Dr. Flatley, we really appreciate what you're doing for the American public. The tragic loss of your daughter, Erin, at a young age. I think we'd like to dedicate this show to her memory and the work that you're doing to help people. I'm sure she would be really proud of you and the advocacy and the expertise, unfortunately, but to the benefit of countless thousands of people. Thank you on behalf of your health.
Thanks, Adam.
We've been listening and talking with Dr. Carl Flatley, endodontist and founder of the Sepsis Alliance. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. The House Call segment of our show today, Laura and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Do we have some interesting things we're going to talk about today?
Well, we always have interesting things we're going to talk about, but today especially.
First question is about what?
About pneumonia. I recently had a moderate bout of pneumonia. A family member said that I'm more likely to get pneumonia again now that I've had it once. Is that true? And if so, what can I do to prevent it?
Well, first off, we talk about pneumonia. Some people hear that term, walking pneumonia, and they think, oh, that's somehow like not so bad because you're still walking. If you're unconscious, pneumonia, that is worse. But pneumonia, sometimes we'll say a mild case of pneumonia. Maybe you didn't even show up on the x-ray, but I could hear it in the lungs. You know, a moderate pneumonia would be, you were pretty sick. I probably could hear it in your lungs, mm-hmm. and you didn't have to go in the hospital. A severe case of pneumonia, you're in the hospital for.
Right.
And usually that's because maybe your oxygen levels went down, you had fever, your blood pressure was low. And does that mean you're more likely to get it? Well, part of it depends on, what caused it. Do you have underlying asthma?
Mm-hmm.
Are you underlying obstructive pulmonary disease? Do you have some sort of restrictive lung disease or, something that makes your lungs mm-hmm. more likely, if it's garden variety pneumonia, let's say from the influenza, which could be really frequent in the winter time. Well, that happens to, pretty healthy people too who get this virus, and that doesn't mean you're more likely. What can you do about it? Well, there are things you can do about it. Well, if you didn't have your flu
really?
Shot, probably a little late, but getting your flu shot actually could certainly cut down on the influenza pneumonia. Bacterial pneumonia, one of the most common causes, is streptococcus. And the pneumococcal vaccination can prevent common cause of pneumonia. Huh. Now, usually we give that to people under the age of 65 who have chronic illnesses, heart or lung disease or immunodeficiency. And over 65, you get the booster shots for both a pneumococcal 13 and a pneumococcal 23. You need both of them. So that is a really good thing that you can do. And I think just taking care of yourself, getting plenty of rest and sleep, not burning the bridges, those would be kind of common sense sort of thing. What's our very next house call?
I recently asked my physician if she would fill out forms for me to go on disability because of depression. She said she would write a note saying that I was depressed but couldn't say I should be on disability, as she felt she was not qualified to make that assessment. What is a patient who's depressed supposed to do?
Well, this is unfortunate for several reasons. First off, you're depressed, and we're really sorry to hear that. And also, you're depressed enough that you feel that you may not be able to work.
Right.
And, depression can be severe, and severe depression acts kind of like severe disease that's not depression, like heart failure or cancer. It's a major illness. And so
right.
It doesn't surprise me that you may not be able to work. I personally wouldn't have any problem.
saying, if you feel you can't work, plus I have objective evidence that you have severe depression, my job is to advocate for you.
Right.
So I wouldn't have a problem with that. I do understand how some physicians might say, well, I don't determine disability. Why am I saying I determine disability? But I might say, I don't think you can work. Your insurer might say you need to go see someone who is mm-hmm. a disability specialist. But I do think that my job is to advocate for your best interests and needs. And it seems like if you think it is, who am I to say differently?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. What are some of the physiological things that go with depression that could prevent people from working? I'm just curious.
Well, the biggest thing is they may not be able to get out of bed.
Yeah, that would make it incredibly hard.
They get so tired after 5 or 10 minutes, they have to lay down.
Mm.
They can't concentrate. They feel so bad about themselves or others, they don't want to talk. Things that you might need to be able to do, which is to get out of bed, talk with someone else.
Right.
And feel okay about yourself. But the good news is all of those things are treatable. So I would hope that this would be what we call short-term disability.
Right, right. Interesting.
Yeah. Hope this person gets better and all our best. What's our next house call?
I have lots of skin tags on my face, and I'm wondering what type of physician removes those. I think they're pretty ugly, and I also don't have a lot of money, so I was hoping you could help.
This is a really difficult question. It seems quite straightforward, but it's not. First off, skin tags on the face are disfiguring for some people. And if you believe that they're disfiguring, I could understand wanting to have
right.
them removed. The problem is that there could be scarring, depending on where they're located, if it's around the eyes or in very sensitive areas. Most physicians aren't going to feel comfortable. So you have to find a physician that's comfortable taking lesions off the face. And then the question would be, well, do I need to see a plastic surgeon? Well, that is going to be expensive.
Right.
You might be able to find a dermatologist who does facial lesion removal, finding someone who is really trained and maybe negotiating. Because if you take them off one at a time and charge one at a time, it's really expensive.
Right.
So maybe say, you know, what would it cost me to take 10 off, which doesn't take that long. But you want someone who's capable, compassionate, and doesn't cost you an arm and a leg.
Right.
So, any other house calls today?
One more? Yes.
Let's hear the last one.
Last one. I have had what my doctors call labile blood pressure. Sometimes it's really low and sometimes it's really high. They've said that I don't need blood pressure medicine because it might drop my blood pressure too low if I were on it. But recently I saw a different doctor who recommended that I go on a medicine called Lisinopril.
Yep.
Right now I'm doing okay, but I'm wondering if you think I should stay on this drug.
It's interesting. People who have what's called labile blood pressure, sometimes really high, sometimes really low, a lot of times that's actually a medical condition called vasodepressor, meaning that the normal chemicals that keep your blood pressure regulated are not regulating it. And so it's actually a medical condition. And the problem is exactly that. If you give someone who's got low blood pressure an anti-blood pressure medication, you're going to drop them out. They already have problems when they stand up, feeling like they're going to pass out. You give them medicine that really does drop the blood pressure, they will pass out. Not only on standing, maybe while they're standing already. And then if you don't put someone on a blood pressure medicine whose blood pressure is, you know, 220 over 130, you wonder and worry, are they going to have a stroke? So those type of patients sometimes do better actually seeing a cardiologist because of how difficult it is in knowing what to do. There are medicines to kind of bolster the blood pressure if it's too low, which can be done. Sounds like you're doing well, and it's hard to do better over doing well. But I think the physician who's just seen you maybe hasn't seen you when your blood pressure was, let's say 80 over 40 and you were in church and they all rallied around you and started praying for you because you had totally passed out.
Right. Yikes. I can only imagine having your blood pressure swing all over the place would just be a very uncomfortable sensation.
Yeah. Difficult condition, worth looking into, worth talking with your provider, maybe seeing a specialist. And we hope that you do well. Speaking of doing well, we want to thank all of our listeners today, Laura. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to listeners, and they can contact us at any time by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or use our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. I want to thank my co-host today in our interview, Dr. Laura Higginbotham, and our guest today, Dr. Carl Flatley. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.